will begin with some opening remarks by Sheila Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. We're picking up where we left off with department-wide support services. If you remember, we heard some about the programs and organization of that entity last week, and this part today would, if we get through it, finish up the department-wide support services discussion for phase one of the hearing. There is a handout in front of you, two parts regarding Office of Information Services. You can either leave that out during today's discussion as they are going over it, or you can put it in your book. If you put it in your book, I would suggest putting it after the last yellow tab in the book, Department-Wide Support Services section. Under the blue tab, the first white tab is the program discussion, and I would put it at the back of that. So that way it's in sync with the rest of the program information. But those are my suggestions, and turn it over to you.
Okay, thank you. Director Weeks, how are you doing?
Fine, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much. Good morning, and good morning, members of the committee. I'm Gary Weeks, Director of the Department of Human Services. And as Sheila said, we've got two sections to go on department-wide services, and then we can talk a little bit about performance measures and reductions. With me on my right is Bill Carl, who is the Chief Information Officer for the department. He'll lead this conversation on the Office of Information Services. I want to remind the committee that the way we have the department organized, while Bill is, for budget purposes, part of department-wide services, the CIO reports directly to the director. He sits on our cabinet with a position equal to the cluster assistant director. So with that sort of reminder, I'll turn to Bill and let him walk you through his presentation on information services.
Thank you, Gary. Chairman Richardson and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Kroll, and I'm the Chief Information Officer for the Department of Human Services. I thought what I might do today is first give a brief overview of what the department or the Office of Information Services does, and then I will probably proceed to the summary of the executive summary of our business plan and discuss that in a little bit greater detail. That really is something new that we've done just in the last 6 months and does provide a roadmap for what we're doing in information services. Before I begin that, though, since I am new to the state government, having just started last April, I thought I'd provide a brief background on myself and my experience in, especially in the area of information technology. I was born in New York and raised in Virginia, have a B.S. in economics from the University of Richmond and an MBA from the University of Virginia. And I played a key role since graduating from the university in areas such as the reorganization of the Penn Central Transportation Company out of bankruptcy when I was a really young man. I served as a Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Financial Systems during President Reagan's first term, 83 to 84, and so I had some experience in government before joining the state of Oregon. I spent most of my career, almost 15 years, in publishing, both with McGraw-Hill and Meredith Corporation out in Des Moines, Iowa, the publishers of Better Homes and Gardens, Lay's Home Journal. And then I also served as president and CEO of a joint venture for Ross Perot, and worked with him closely, and it was on the whole areas of reengineering of businesses, which I spent a lot of time doing through technology, quality management, and the application of technology. As I said today, I'll first provide a brief overview of the Office of Information Systems. Our mission is to provide all the information technology that supports the DHS missions, including managing cases, determining client eligibility, and managing client information for the department on all forms of reporting. We are also key players in many of the state initiatives. As one of the largest departments of state government, we're very actively engaged in activities such as leading IT performance measurement initiatives throughout the state, computer network and infrastructure consolidation, activities. We've been involved in a number of initiatives such as the learning management system, which the state recently identified, our IT asset management initiatives, and are going to be playing a major role in applying some of the technologies around licensing throughout the government. The Organization for Information or the Office of Information Services is comprised of six major operating units. First of all, we have our customer service and support organization. These are the individuals that serve as the first line of communications with over 9,500 staff that are part of the Department of Human Services. They manage our help desk and service desk, and they provide all the technical support services in the field. Our network and computing services organization manages, as we'd like to refer to it, the boxes and wires that make up technology. And this is the unit that is going to be play a major role in the consolidation of our network and computing services functions. We formed a special unit, which we call Strategic Systems Initiatives. These are the IT projects that are of major importance to the department, such as the Medicaid Management Information System and our statewide automated child welfare information system, and a lot of other strategic initiatives across the department. We have a fairly large group that maintains our application systems that exist today, and I'll talk about that a little later because it is a major area of our responsibility. Systems architecture provides expertise. These are our most senior technologists within the department, and they provide oversight on all of our major application activities, databases, and those kinds of functions. And lastly, we have an administrative unit. We're about 287 people and roughly $200 million budget, so there's a lot of administration to do of an organization of that size, and we have a small group that does that. We also have a project management office, which provides project management expertise not only to the IT department but to the whole Department of Human Services. So anyone who is initiating a project-type function, we can come in and provide them expertise on how to manage those kinds of activities. And finally, we have a policy and planning organization, which, as it would imply, name would imply, deals with major IT policies and planning activities throughout the department. As I indicated, over the last 6 months, I've led an effort within the department to establish a business plan, and I'd like to just cover briefly that from the executive summary that we left you. I won't go through the slide presentation. That's the essence of the plan. It's about a six-year time frame in terms of what we need to do and what issues we need to address in the department in terms of technology. It's a little unique in the sense that there are four major elements for each area of technology that we reviewed in the department. The first is an assessment or a point of departure. I feel very strongly if you don't know where you are in terms of technology or any activity that your organization is engaged with, you'll not steer a very clear path of where you need to go. So in each of the areas, we start with a very in-depth assessment of that area of our operations, or as we call it, the point of departure. That analysis leads us to a set of issues that we need to address within the organization, and out of those issues come the strategies that will lead to solutions to those issues. And finally, we present what we call a point of arrival, which is really a measurement or a metric that says, you know, when we've gotten to this point, we will have accomplished this mission, and we will have implemented this strategy and addressed these issues. So that's the basic structure of the plan. In terms of the assessment, there were a number of issues that came forward out of this, and it was really an enlightening experience for me and I think the rest of the members of the cabinet. First of all, DHS was combined a few years ago, I guess two or three, and was in effect seven agencies that were brought together, and before that happened they had seven separate IT organizations. So you can imagine a fairly siloed view of the world. As we looked at the at the applications, for example, we found that we had over 250 applications within the department, and these applications were written in 22 different languages. So this was not like being in the United States. It was more like being in Europe in terms of the number of different languages that were out there. In addition, those 250 applications were used nine different database management systems and five different technological platforms, so mainframes, servers, and the like types of platforms. Very, very complex environment in which to operate. In the desktop arena, our technology was so old in terms of being about 7 to 10 years old, that we actually had what we call 69 different configurations for the PCs that we had to manage. We call that images in our business, but there were 69 different types of PCs out on the desktops that we had to be expert in and able to support. Recently, we've started our replacement and upgrading of that technology, and that's going to dramatically simplify that area of our business. Almost half of our staff are assigned to just maintaining these 250 plus applications, which is a fairly large investment for an organization like ours to have to dedicate people just to maintain and keep the current applications running on a day-to-day basis. We also found that our technologies were relatively old, and for example, we had 59 different client databases. So if you're trying to be a department that has a single view of your customer and knows them and knows what programs and activities and how you're supporting, that's difficult to do when you have them in so many different places throughout your technology infrastructure. There was also a lack of standardized tools within the organization, a great deal of inflexibility. In fact, instead of being an enabler of our program activities to provide better services, we were actually inhibitors to that process, and that's something we need to change. And historically, planning had been focused on the clusters or lower business units, so we didn't have a very broad view of the department. Security was a major issue.
Just one moment.
Yes, sir.
A minute ago you said there were 59, I thought you said 59 different client database. Was that correct?
Senator Richardson, yes, that is correct. Excuse me, Representative Richardson, that is correct.
What does that really mean?
Well, it means
client database. Which clients are we talking about?
Well, these would be individuals that are part of our different program areas, whether it would be child welfare or food stamps or medical services of one type or another. And we had built different systems that had these individuals in them. So when they would come in for services, we have to look across a broad array of systems to find out information relative to them as customers of the department.
And you'd said that there was seven separate departments that had their own IT. Right, or IS groups, and that they've all been consolidated into one. Is that correct?
Representative Richie, yes, that is correct.
Did that result in efficiencies as far as numbers of FTE and costs for the consolidation? Did Oregon recognize a benefit financially from that consolidation?
Representative Richie, I haven't been here long enough. Maybe
the answer, Mr. Chairman, the answer to that is yes. We started that consolidation when I took over this job in 1995, and we merged not only IT, but all the other support services within the department, and that took about two sessions. And we were, frankly, helped along, as Sheila may remember, on that, because in one biennium our budget was reduced by $3 million, I think it was, in order from the administration to give us the incentive to do this. So the legislature purposely reduced the admin cost in order to encourage us to make this happen as quickly as possible.
Okay. Thank you.
And I have looked through the history, and we have had a series of improvements in efficiency, and I would expect more as we go forward, as we improve. We still have a lot of work to do to improve this current situation. And one of the issues that we face that's really, really critical to me as the CIO is the transformation of our staff skills. We have a lot of individuals who have familiar with older technologies, and we really need to transform their skills. We need to give them training. We need to have them work with some of the newer technologies as we move forward. In terms of strategies that we're implementing through the plan, we've already implemented a number of improvements in our customer relations, as we like to call it, with the various members of the clusters and the department itself. We have initiated an IT governance council, which is made up of all of the deputy assistant directors of the various clusters within the organization. And this group provides policy direction and oversight and allows me to assure that as we move forward with various IT initiatives, that they're aligned to meet the business goals of the agency. We are also in the process of strengthening what we call our information systems management councils or groups. These are cluster organizations that represent both the business and IT within the various work units or clusters in which we work in the department. And this is a very important organization or function within the department because it helps us to set the priorities for our work and to schedule the activities of our staff to make sure, again, that we're working on the things that are most important to the department. We've improved dramatically the communications within the department of what we're doing. I send out every 2 weeks a CIO newsletter, which keeps the department informed on the various activities that are going on within OIS. And we're looking to transform ourselves into leaders and people who are helping provide better strategic direction to the organization. In terms of the technical complexity and modernization, there are a couple of very key strategies there that we're implementing. One is the sense of understanding that we have a very complex business within the Department of Human Services. We're in many different businesses, and we need technology portfolios or sets of applications that relate to what the different businesses that we are within the department. And this will help us and guide us in terms of how to reduce the complexity of these applications that we're managing from kind of 250 diverse applications to maybe a dozen major applications within the organization. To give you an example, and there's some in the business plan, we have an insurance and claim processing business, a fairly large one, with Medicaid. And our Medicaid management information systems modernization, which we're involved with in this biennium, really we'll get into the design and implementation of that new system, is a really crucial element of those portfolios and will provide a lot of standardization and elimination of a lot of these smaller systems that have grown up over the years. The same is true in our protective services arena. Protective services is actually, there's two elements of it. We have our child welfare information system, which we're proposing a major upgrade to that system in the next biennium also. But senior protective services have a lot of similarities to child protective services, and so we think we can share that technology on that basis. In addition, self-sufficiency is a big element of the department. There's some 30 self-sufficiency programs that we manage, and today they have a lot of different applications that support them, but they have great similarities amongst them in terms of how people are enrolled and eligibility determination, case management tools, the payment of benefits, the reporting. There's a lot of similarity across those systems, and we think, again, we can look for a single system in self-sufficiency that is not in this year's or this biennium's plan to address at this point, but we'll certainly be studying it and getting ready to modernize that part of our applications. We've also found, and this one we're moving on fairly quickly, is in the area of licensing. There are some 50-plus licensing applications within the Department of Human Services, many of them within public health, but also in child CAF, which is Children and Families, and in SPD for seniors and people with disabilities. Each of those programs have have substantial number of licensing activities going on. Working with the CIO Council for the state and with DC CIO Council.
Spell it out for us.
Chief Information Officers Council.
Okay. Dropping into acronyms.
Yes, I understand. And working with the it's DCBS, Department of Consumer and Business Services, they have selected a common system for the state for licensing, and we have adopted that system. It's called License 2000, produced by a company called Systems Automation, and we believe we can standardize all of our applications in the license area on a single platform to service all those different licensing programs, and at the same time bring them online to the consumer, bring them onto the web and available for online services. And that's really important in terms of our strategy, because today, if you look at the department's IT organization, it's spread over such a vast array of different technologies that it's I like to think of it as a veneer. It's very hard to get any depth of knowledge and expertise either in the businesses that we support or in the technologies that we use. And so if we can get to this smaller number of common applications used across the department, we'll be able to build staffs that have, you know, substantial knowledge of the business that they're supporting as well as the technology. So instead of having one or two people spread across all these different applications, we'd have two or three. Or, you know, a dozen people who would really know the area of licensing. another key strategy that we're implementing is a buy versus build strategy. Historically, the department, whenever we've looked at an application, has come to the conclusion that in Oregon we're so unique that we have to create the applications ourselves. And we're really pushing against the trend in this business plan, and getting quite a bit of support from the clusters and the business organizations, because I think we all are beginning to realize that if we can purchase a software that is doing the same function and already exists in the marketplace, we dramatically reduce the time it takes us to get those systems up and running and have use of that new technology. It will dramatically reduce the cost of those projects, especially if we can implement them, as I like to say, plain vanilla, without a lot of modifications to the core technology. And third, it dramatically reduces the risk of those types of projects. So we're moving in that direction. And then another kind of way of managing risk in this area, and this is obviously, as you know, an area fraught with risks and concerns, is that many of the applications that we're looking at are fundamental operating systems that are needed to run the department. And we don't necessarily have to address those all on a statewide basis immediately. So if you look at child welfare or self-sufficiency systems or even licensing, we can implement those on a test basis or as a pilot system and really work out all of the issues and concerns and questions that we have in terms of how best to implement those systems on a small scale, which again presents a lot less risk to the organization. And once we have them really well defined, then roll them out on a statewide basis. We like to think of it as our piloting strategy within the department. Staff transformation, as I said, is critical. It is an issue of training of individuals in the newer technologies and then being prepared to assign people to actually apply the technology and the knowledge that they've worked. We've formed a special resource management council within OIS that is looking across all of our organizations, looking at what our needs are and what the needs will be in the future and planning the processes to manage that transformation. Culture is really critical in this transformation of IT that needs to take place. We're starting to think about being a we culture, not us versus them or, you know, something different, but the fact that we're in this together and that we have to have that sense of teamwork that's required to make this type of transition happen. We're building a results-oriented organization as well. We're holding people accountable many times for the first time recently in their careers, and expecting that they will accomplish certain activities. The plan, for example, as I said, is a 6-year time frame and horizon, very similar to what's in the department's budget in terms of a time frame for our systems. But we're managing that on an annual basis and down to quarter to quarter. So on a quarter to quarter basis, we have plans that we are expecting ourselves to implement, and we hold ourselves accountable to achieve those. And we're working on.
Who actually is involved in the decision making on what platforms you're going to be you buy and negotiating the deals? Is that in your office or is that done elsewhere?
Representative Richardson. Principally in my office is that accountability, but we involve, depending on the nature of the application, our IT Governance Council, which is this group that from the business and from IT that oversee our overall activities. We also bring those kinds of issues to the cabinet and to the director and deputy director's office also.
Well, Mr. Chairman, may I add one more thing, too? I don't want to overlook the fact that we always review these things with the Joint Information Technology Committee that meets throughout the interim and then with the technology group that meets during the session. So,
yes.
There's legislative review of any major acquisition, any funding plan, and so on.
Okay. Yes. Just for my own information, you have a lot of background. You've been inside and outside of government. Are you personally satisfied that Oregon's getting the best deals for this transition, buying off-the-shelf products if it was your money, would you be spending this amount of money, or are there things that we can be doing to increase the efficiency in the purchase?
Representative Richardson and members of the committee, I'm pleased that in a lot of the things that I've seen, that doesn't say that we can't sometimes do better, but if you look at the Smart Buy program that the Department of Administrative Services ran, we were able to do substantially better than we had been as a state when we consolidated our purchases for PCs and laptops. And we had pretty close to probably a 40 to 45% reduction in our average purchase price through that program. And so we've seen a lot of areas where our consolidated purchasing is having a significant impact. Another example of efficiencies that I'm very much a supporter of and have been since the day I arrived is our CNIC project, our Computer Network and Infrastructure Consolidation Initiative. That is underway at this point, and I believe we'll easily save the $5 to $10 million annually in our business case, but we'll at the same time also dramatically improve the quality of services that are available to our various organizations through this new data center. We'll have a very professional, first class operation. We'll have all the kinds of environmental capabilities that we don't necessarily have today and have had issues with. We'll have dramatically improved security since we'll be designing that in the front end in a very safe and secure facility that we haven't really experienced. So I think there's a lot of examples where the state has been has been very effective in coordinating its efforts to reduce costs. The costs of some of the applications that we're implementing, we have looked at what it costs other states to accomplish those similar type systems, and we're kind of on the aggressive side of trying to keep those costs under control and to implement these systems in a more rapid time frame. A key to that will be our ability to implement the core technologies without major modifications that we're looking at, and that's something I will argue with with our own organization on an ongoing basis. I really think in order to make modifications, which is where the cost and the risk come in, you need a very solid business case to support that. We have to know that this is going to help save more children, or it's going to dramatically improve the efficiency of our organization, or there has to be a very strong business case to support changes.
If you become aware of areas where we can improve and be more efficient in reducing costs in our purchasing, would you please let me know?
Oh, more than happy to.
Thank you. Please continue.
A very important element of our plan, and I'll pretty much end with this, is in the area of security. This has been, as many of you know who have been briefed by the state's Chief Information Officer, Don Fleming, or members of DAS who are involved in this this initiative, this has been an area of significant concern. There were a lot of vulnerabilities across state government, and quite frankly, a few significant ones within the Department of Human Services. Once we had this audit done, which was a very well-done professional kind of attack on our systems by known people to tell us where the issues were, we've made dramatic progress to tighten up the security of our existing systems, and we'll make even greater, I think, improvements in security as we move to the new consolidated data center, statewide data center. So this is an area of extreme importance. We're implementing what we call a defense in depth strategy, which basically says our people know and have an appreciation for the for security, that there are programs in place to implement better security, that the technology things that we need to do are done, that we can, when there is a problem, we know it, which is something that has been a problem in the past. We didn't always know that we had these risks, so to speak, and when they were being when we were being attacked. And when we do have issues, we'll be able to mitigate them much more quickly. And that's a really important part of our mission, is to improve the security of our systems. So with that,
Mr. Chair,
Senator Masterson,
thank you. Just to put this in perspective, I started working for Clackamas County in 1988. We didn't even have computers for billing, and so there was a major transformation that we saw. When you have nurses and when you have a staff that have never ever worked on a computer, and then all of a sudden putting computers in. And I want to cite the example of communicable disease, because I know that at the state level you had had staff that had their own person who really was ahead of everybody else and developed their own software or database for communicable disease. And yet nurse practitioners or clinics who had those same patients weren't really able to access the communicable disease. And it may be because of security and confidentiality, I don't know. But are those types of systems at the county level being, I mean, they're county, but they report to the state, mm-hmm. and yet the county have to go out for their own RFPs and getting their own databases, mm-hmm. et cetera, for their own internal organization. Is there coordination among those pieces in the state?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Moniz Anderson, there is a coordination. It's improving. I'm a member of what is known as the Oregon Association of Government IT Management, which is the county level CIOs or chief information officers, directors of technology at the county level. And we're beginning to discuss with them initiatives that we are undertaking within state government that have an impact on them. In fact, I'm starting to get other agencies calling me saying, "Who in the county can we talk? Counties can we talk to?" And I've recommended that we work through this association of county IT managers. Examples of that, we're implementing a new system in June, or actually July 1st. It's called Express. It is a payment system that is for developmental disabilities, mental health, and addictive services. Covers a certain set of service codes within the Department of Human Services. There's about $800 million of benefits that are associated with these programs, and we'll be implementing this new system. And we're coordinating a series of, in fact, I think March 15th, we start a pilot test of that application with each of the state, with each of the counties. We've been running what we call NetLinks, which are web-enabled training sessions with them over the last several months so that they've become familiar with this application. We'll be involving them with user acceptance testing, which starts, I think, in April, April-May time period. And I've brought in, again, this association of IT managers to brief them so they're prepared when we bring this system to the counties that they're aware of it, know who's involved, know who to contact, and the like. So I'm making a great deal of effort to involve the counties in the development of our initiatives.
Just follow up.
I
know it's extremely frustrating when you finally get staff trained in one. You know which buttons to push, and you know when to scroll and how to get a patient, et cetera. And yet it's ever evolving, and that I think was the greatest frustration for me, because I could see where efficiencies could occur, but I didn't. But working with the state, working with environmental health, working with the communicable disease program, the immunization program, all of them had their own silos, and I'm not sure how close we are into coordinating some of those databases or information sharing, but let's just say you can have a vision and a plan, but boy, implementing it at the ground level is a whole different story.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator, just sort of by way of expanding this, because this is history that Bill doesn't know, we've had such an open system, DHS has, because of our relationship with the counties in mental health, addiction services, public health, that for years they've piggybacked on our networks. And I think the time that this struck us the most was the night we were bringing in Y2K, you know, the December 31. I was there all night with our staff at 10 o'clock, 2 hours before we switch over. We get a call from Benton County saying, hey, we just discovered that all of our communications for emergency management services, police, fire, and emergency services are running on your backbone. Well, we're getting ready to shut that down in 2 hours. It's shut down completely, and then it's brought back up for Y2K to bring all the Y2K. So in 2 hours, we had to do a workaround so the county could continue to have its communication system and everything using our backbone. We had no idea that that was going on, because we weren't able to track who was using our system, and that gave us the first. I mean, we knew a lot of county services were running off of our system, coming in and out. And that gave us the first dramatic example of what it was. And now we're trying to not close that off, but we need to know who's in our system and who's using it for what purposes and so on. And that's what Bill's saying, is we're trying to coordinate this with the counties. I mean, before he got here, I was meeting with county chief information officers to talk about their needs and how they were already using our system so we could blend these things together. So we are aware of the problem. We're trying to work with the counties, and we're trying to bring up systems that are not only going to be helpful to us, but are going to be helpful to county government as well, because they are one of our prime contractors. So. But it was pretty startling to learn that, you know, a set of services like emergency management running on our backbone. So,
will the Express system be able to be utilized in other areas than just mental and addictive services?
Mr. Chairman, it is principally targeted towards those applications. What's unique about Express is the change in the underlying business processes for the program areas that it is servicing. Traditionally, in developmental disabilities, mental health, and addictive services, in those areas, the payments are largely made through Medicaid. But what had happened traditionally is that the department would establish these programs, and then 1/12 of the expected budget was paid out to the counties and then to providers on an annual basis or a monthly basis. And then at the end of the biennium, there was a fairly substantial reconciliation process that had to to take place, and it's been years behind schedule in many instances. But they'd have to look at, well, what total funds did they get paid for a particular service? What are the actual expenses did they incur, and did they owe the government or the state money in this area, but, you know, drew down too much in this area, and it was a fairly significant reconciliation. What's different about Express is that we established the budgets up front, and they're in the application system itself. And then as they make drawdowns or as they make requests for those payments, they reconcile automatically against the total funds that are available, and that's depleted over time. And so at the end, you know, they either have a little bit or, you know, just enough money to cover their expenses as they finish their efforts. So it's actual expenditures against the budget that are accounted for in the system, and that's a pretty big change. And we'll generate a number of administrative savings, I think, in the counties and in the state, and reduce the need for these significant reconciliations to take place.
So I'm wondering, is if we are trying to have less platforms or less software packages, mm-hmm. whether, I mean, Medicaid has multiple programs, but many of them are very similar, except you just change some of the factors, you know, some of the mm-hmm. You know, the rates and those kinds of things. I'm wondering if Express is only going to function for mental health and addictive services, or will there be a separate software program completely for developmentally disabled and completely mm-hmm. separate mm-hmm. from others, or can Express or something like that be utilized in multiple areas using Medicaid?
Mr. Chairman, the plan is to integrate Express into the new MMIS information system, and it will be a payment vehicle that's tightly integrated with the new MMIS system. The new MMIS system will include other types of Medicaid payment programs that will come in directly into the system, hopefully in electronic form. It will also include a capability for providers to enter transactions directly through the web into the system for payment, as well as have an enhanced paper processing, what we call an electronic data document management system, which will allow us to process any manual forms much more quickly.
Was that a yes?
Well, it's,
I mean, I'm not sure.
Yes.
If you answer the question, it can Express be utilized for other applications within Medicaid, or do you have to have separate software packages for every application?
Mr. Chairman, no. The answer is yes, it will be used for other applications within the Medicaid environment, but not for all of their applications, because they'll have a different set of requirements.
Thank you.
Okay. No.
That's right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're going to move on now to the finance and policy area, which is the last area within department-wide support services, and Vic Todd's going to join us up here to walk us through all the work that goes on in finance and policy analysis.
Chair Richardson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Vic Todd. I'm the Assistant Director for Finance and Policy with the Department of Human Services. Today I wanted to spend a few minutes talking about the history of finance and policy, briefly describe some of the functions that we perform, and talk a little bit about key challenges that we face as we work towards improving the utility of this cluster. I use the term utility because this area is essentially a planning function that helps all areas of the department, and so it's very much a supportive area. I'll be working off of pages 22 through 24 in your document, following the white overview tab in the department-wide support services area. In addition, there are two handouts that you have that I'll be referring to as we move through this discussion. Finance and policy supports the department's mission through providing policy and fiscal analysis for the department's numerous programs. Areas of analysis that we focus on can result from issues that develop internally to the department as well as many that are externally driven, such as from federal law changes, et cetera. The goals on page 22 lay out the key focuses of the cluster. Finance and policy was established in 2000 as part of the EHS reorganization plan. The actual consolidation, however, of the functions didn't occur until the fall of 2001 following the approval of House Bill 2294 in the 2001 session. The outcomes that were desired from the consolidation were to improve the overall operations of the various functions that were consolidated. The primary focus on improving the cross-cluster planning and cross-departmental planning when looking at any specific issues. The department also at that time needed to establish a department-wide cost allocation plan. As you hear over and over, the department had, you know, seven different organizations, and in that instance they had seven, well, more than seven, different cost allocation plans that were negotiated separately. Another key issue that existed was to establish alignment between budget structures and accounting structures, and to develop a department-wide budget structure that came across the department, so you could look at various areas of the department and be familiar with the structure. The bullets on page 23 highlight many of the services that we provide in this cluster. And the key piece there for us is that it requires very active participation with all areas of the department, as well as with the external partners. With the initial reorganization of the department, there were two areas of rate setting that were also consolidated into the finance and policy area. The long-term care rate setting group and the OHP actuarial services group. Long-term care rate setting is responsible for reviewing and setting rates and for monitoring and compliance for all of the long-term care rate setting areas, including nursing facilities, residential care facilities, et cetera. Long-term care facilities are required to remit annual cost reports that are then financially analyzed by this group to ensure compliance with the appropriate reimbursement regulations. The actuarial services rate unit is responsible for working with the department's contracted actuary, that's PricewaterhouseCoopers, and they develop the managed care capitation rates and physician care organization rates, et cetera. The unit works with the actuary to prepare and validate encounter data and to do analysis before this data is submitted to the actuary to help reduce the amount of work the actuary actually has to do for us. The first handout that I've given you simply intended to provide, simply intended to provide you with a perspective of the frequent interaction that we have with legislative fiscal, the legislature, e-board in the off-session year, and to point out that the department is a little different than most agencies of state government, and that is that every 6 months we come back to the e-board and do rebalance plans, and essentially that is to look at all of the department's programs and issues as they develop and bring that back to you to review and make recommendations as to changes. It highlights for me that the continuous planning cycle that we're engaged in terms of trying to stay ahead of the issues and help the department with its planning. One of the key issues for us in terms of this consolidation was that while we brought the various functions, budget-related functions, together into one entity from these seven different organizations, we wanted to ensure that these staff maintained a strong connection to the various program areas. That has been a continuous focus for us, and I think we've in the last few years strengthened the capacity of the department to look at issues and look at them as departmental issues, and to do a better job of bringing in those crossover implications that often occur. Of course, that being said, we still have a lot of areas that we are still working on and will continue to work on to improve what it is we're able to do for the department. A good example of this is the work that we're doing around forecasting and the process that we are putting in place to make that a department-wide effort and to make it I'm referencing now the second handout that I gave you in terms of where I'm going. During the past year, the department has made a concerted commitment to move towards having a consolidated forecasting structure. Various efforts occurred in prior bienniums to accomplish this, but the resources were not there and were not dedicated to accomplishing this. And there are many reasons why it did not kind of proceed to become a departmental priority. And I'll touch on some of those issues in a moment. But in creating this unit, the overall overarching goal that we had was to ensure that we were producing reliable and objective forecasts that were very public and very identifiable in terms of the various program areas that we were responsible for. There are three major components to the effort that we're doing. We have established a forecasting unit, and we'll be requesting positions to make that a permanent situation. But in doing this, we have established this forecasting unit, and on slide one, it lays out the three components that I'm going to talk about here. First, the forecasting unit obviously is responsible for producing the biennial forecasts, and they are supported by what we refer to as program steering committees. And those steering committees are made up of staff from the various clusters, legislative, fiscal staff, and budget management staff. They help to identify the various risks that may be out there that the forecast group may not initially be aware of, and help to guide that process along.
Question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Moss Anderson.
When you're saying forecasts, you're not talking outcomes. I mean,
this Representative Richardson, Senator Anderson, this is forecasting of the various program caseloads of the department.
Pardon? The
various program caseloads.
The caseload.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, maybe let me just say one thing. This was the most important thing when I took this job for the second time a year ago in March, was for me to establish this. This was a high priority for the governor, and I think it was a high priority for anybody that worked with the department around the numbers of clients that we bring forward, because you base many of your decisions on what we tell you in terms of how many clients are going to be in the health plan, how many clients are going to be served by foster care, and so on like that. And the department has for years been criticized because of its inability to give you good numbers. Now, I think that's a challenge. That would be a challenge for any organization, given the ebb and flow of our clients and the variety of eligibility requirements that have to be met. But we had not historically done a very good job. So when I came in to this job and sat down with Vic, I said, we're gonna find a way to create a forecasting unit. And we did that. Without additional resources from you, we put together some staffing and brought a group together to begin to do real good forecasting models, just the same kind of principles we want to act on, as does the governor's economic forecasting group. And if you see the peer review group, which Vic will probably get to here in a minute, I'm interrupting him, and we have a separate, outside of our organization, group of economists and forecasting people that now review all of our caseload forecasts that include university staff, private sector, the state's economist, LFO, budget and management department, the state's demographer. All those people come together to review our forecast numbers now in an effort to try to give you the very best numbers we can so that you can have a basis with some assurance to base the budget on. And so I interrupt Vic on this because I just want you to understand how important I think this particular function is to the department, and I think ultimately to the governor and to you, if you're going to put a budget together that's based on any real good sound data. So, Vic.
Okay. So as Gary said, he had a strong interest in making this happen, and so what we did, and he's touched on the peer review group and contracted technical review group. Slide two, actually I've laid out some of what he's described in terms of describing the participants in this, and I think it's real critical that the external group that we have, it meets on a regular basis as well and provide input, and we have contracted with Looking Glass Analytics out of Olympia, Washington. They helped develop the model, the base model, and they continue to provide technical support to us as we continue to develop this. So as Gary mentioned, we have very good representation on the external peer review group from around the state. Slide three displays for you the various program areas that we are in the process of beginning to use this group to forecast. And in actuality, the April 05 forecast will be the first time that we have relied on this group to forecast all of these caseloads.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Wessler?
I apologize. I think I've started a new company this morning called Testifiers Are Us, so I've got to go testify on another bill. But before I get out of here for a couple of minutes, I wanted to ask, as it relates to the April 05 rebalance, do you have any unfair question, but do you have any inklings as to what the long-term care caseloads are looking like? Are you to the point where you can give a guesstimate that they're going to hold steady, be up a little, be up more than you were thinking? Any characterization you can share with us?
Chair Richardson, Senator Westland, at this point we are still in the process of finalizing what those numbers for all these program caseloads, so it would be premature really to talk about that.
You know, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I recall looking at a comparison between caseload for like long-term care of the elderly that was used in determining the governor's recommended budget and comparing that with the November rebalance. And there were some significant changes in the caseloads, and I wasn't aware of any major change that would have affected that. Are you, first of all, do you know what I'm talking about, the changes, and could you comment on it?
The Representative Richardson, certainly. I guess the core premise here is that there will always be changes in terms of a forecast, and so I'm not certain of the specific ones you're referencing, but we will all of the caseloads will have a revised estimate, and they will not, you know, mirror what was in the forecast in the November estimates.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it would be hard to compare the November rebalance with the governor's budget because it wasn't out in November.
Right, but it was proposed in December.
It was, yeah, right, but you couldn't, we were making, there were no comparisons that would have been possible then because we hadn't released any numbers for the governor's budget at that time. I think the question that we're all about is long-term care look like it's going up? And the answer is yes. And what Vic's unable to tell us right now, I think, is what's the growth rate at now? We, in the April rebalance, we'll be getting into those numbers, and we have a reshoot for the 05-07 budget, which will occur in April as well. I mean, assuming you stay on the regular schedule. And, stuff, so.
And if I may, Mr. Chair, that was that's really the answer to my question. I mean, I was looking for if they had an inkling. We all know what's going up. It's a question, is the
what's
the angle
trajectory
going
look like?
Steeper than we were anticipating, if you had an answer for that yet. So that, I mean, the answer is no, that is the answer that I was looking for. They don't have it. But they will.
But we, yes, sir.
Yes.
Senator Wessler, we will.
Mr. Chair, if I can clarify, the governor's budget includes the impact for the 2005-07 biennium of the changes that were made in the 2003-05 rebalance plan in November.
Right.
So, in effect, there wouldn't be any difference between the governor's budget and the rebalance plan in terms of the projection that was used for the November rebalance plan is the one that the governor's budget was built on. Now, obviously, there are going to be differences in the 05-07 caseload numbers than the numbers for the 2003-05 biennium. But the basis of the forecast, that forecast was used in building the governor's budget. And this last few minutes of discussion basically just is a foreshadowing that we will have revised forecasts that will be coming in April for both, that will affect both the 03-05 budgets and the 05-07 budgets. And we will, the department will get those to us in April and we'll bring them forward to the subcommittee.
Thank you.
The last comment on slide three is that this array of programs represents about 95% of the department's program budgets. So this group has a very comprehensive task ahead of them in terms of forecasting all of these program areas. This effort that we are undertaking represents a lot of challenges that we have to make this work. As you have heard over the last several weeks, the department's programs are complex, and the interaction between the programs in terms of the clients is also very complex. Some of the complexity of the challenges we face are really associated with the department's history, in that it was seven, you know, essentially departments, and they had seven at least different computer systems, and those systems were primarily designed as payment systems, not databases or client counting systems. And so in many cases what you had was an adaptation of that payment system to create a count of a client group. And so what we're faced with is the fact that we have many different definitional sets in these systems around what is a client, what is a case, what is a household. And so a challenge for this forecasting group in order to utilize this model is to, you know, come up with a new set of core definitions for clients. And slide number four is kind of a visual depiction of, you know, what is a client in terms of how you count it. And so the example there has three client episodes, if you will, and shows the various ways that it can be counted depending upon how you want to define it. Of course, the one the one additional et cetera that's left off there is that the beginning of the month count is one, the ending of the month count is one, and then you have variations in between there. So that's kind of a high-level look at what that challenge is. The next slide shows you an array of actual definitions that exist. I'm not going to go through those, but you can see what confusion that can create in terms of coming up with what is a client. It's not to say that those definitions are wrong. It's just that from a departmental perspective, there is not a single definition. So as you move to...
In looking at page 5 on the definitions, and I'm just learning this, so you got to help me with this. On why would you count people? I mean, isn't there an average of people that you would see and you wouldn't see? I see all these definitions. I'm not really sure which ones you count and which ones you don't. But isn't there an average? To me, it would seem like you'd want to count them all because that's in your best interest financially. But isn't there an average of people who show or you can't?
Representative Richardson, Senator Moniz Anderson, what we're trying to move to is a service-based definition so that rather than it being a definition that starts with a payment basis, we're moving towards using a service basis. So we count a client unduplicated based upon a service. The way some of these systems work now, a client during the course of a month may move between a program area. And so from a program counting standpoint, you may not pick them up as a count in an earlier program that they actually were in, although the payment is charged to the right program. And so that's kind of the underlying issue, is to move out from under that and start looking at these programs as a service level and define the clients that way.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Melissa Anderson, we are able to get an unduplicated headcount today.
Okay.
So we know how many unduplicated individuals received one or more services, and then we know, and then we can back down to say what it was, which services were it was, or what cluster it was in, and then we can also back down to say which clients received two or more, three or more, and so on. And that's taken us a long time to get to that stage. Now we're trying. These are all questions that legislators will ask us, and so we wind up giving the chair a number. How many clients do we have? And then someone says, well, how many families do you serve? And so we give that number. And then the department is constantly in this thing, well, I got from the department this number of families served in. Well, I got this number of clients served. Those are not the same. Those are different, And so we are trying to come to some definitions that are a little bit more standard and can be used by you all for budget purposes and stuff, because these aren't all budget-driven definitions here. There are a variety of purposes that they're used for. So we're trying to come up with some definitions that are beneficial to Ways and Means and to the governor to really make some decisions around program size. So.
And we're dealing with data, and certainly the data is the first step toward accountability, not just in the use of funds, but in hopefully determining if we're doing any good other than serving meals and paying benefits and those kinds of things. I mean, the ultimate goal, as is said in some of DHS literature, is to work out of the job, right? I mean, to help people become self-reliant. That's one of the mission components of the mission statement. And yet, most of the focus is on outputs. How much did we do? How many people did we serve in this capacity? But very little emphasis on how many people are we not going to have to serve anymore because of what we're doing is really making a difference in their lives. And we do have the one, I think it's a performance measure, that says how many people who are off of TANF come back within 18 months. I mean, that is a useful point of information because it lets us know if they get off, are they coming back. But ultimately the goal and what we do, we need to be focusing on some way to measure, are we doing any good other than just giving people meals or giving them a place to stay or giving them medical treatment? You know, are we helping people become more self-reliant? Is an issue that we really need to focus, as well as these other things.
Chair Richardson, one of the comments that Gary just made I wanted to follow up a little bit on, and that is that while we can currently identify unique clients and services in the camp, the problem we have currently is that we cannot do that on a regular basis. We have what we call an integrated client database, but in order to utilize that, the information is fairly dated, and staff have to spend a lot of time cleaning the data to make it unique. And so we're working with the Office of Information Systems to enable us to have that on a more frequent basis and ultimately on a monthly basis, so that we can in fact look at those dynamics between programs specific to clients. And so that's an effort that's underway.
And we become our own worst enemies, as you mentioned, Senator Montesantis, last week or the week before, that at one point it looked like you were saying that in a Healthy Start, you were able to visit two people a day because so much of the time was being spent on paperwork. And I had other members, workers in DHS, say that over 50% of their time is spent on paperwork. And so in our move toward efficiency, where you require more data, which takes more time, creates more paperwork, and makes it less efficient. And so it's, that which we try to help, sometimes we hurt by our mere requirements. We don't always see the consequences of our requests. Senator?
Yeah. What's the average? Do you usually overestimate or underestimate?
Chair Richardson, Senator Moniz Anderson, on average, we're right.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Montana, I think a lot of people would tell you we always underestimate. It seems like we're back here regularly saying the caseload is going up, and maybe it's because we're trying to be as conservative as possible. But some of these things are... because of all the variables out there, so difficult to predict. I think we've actually done better in the last couple of years. But I mean, I've had the same sense of frustration when I was running DAS, trying to put a governor's budget together. As Vic knows, leaning on the department saying, "Give me the number. How many people are going to be in the health plan in the next biennium? The governor's budget's got to get done." And the number would change pretty regularly, and I probably was like some of you at one point called the department and said, "I don't care what the number is, give me a number, you know," and because we got to get a budget out and stuff. And we want to be in a better position where we can say with some confidence, here's a good number. It's been reviewed by people outside this agency that are experts, economists, education people who do a lot of forecasting. And we have some backup. I mean, that's the thing that the state's economist has that we don't have. The state's economist brings you a revenue forecast, and he does the best job he can, but he has it reviewed by a lot of experts who stand behind the forecast. That's what we're trying to get to, is the same sort of thing where there are lots of people looking at the numbers, lots of people who can say, well, did you consider this? Did you consider that? And we can, you know, have a pooled expertise to try to get you the best information we can.
Sure. Senator Winter.
I've been very quiet down here. If we don't get good data and get good outcomes and good information, it's been massaged, and Director Weeks and I've had this conversation over last session, and then there's conversation that was with Gene Thorne over previous sessions. It's very critical, and he knows that I believe that they need to have the tools with which to be able to give us the kind of data that we request, that we need in order to make good policy decisions, because when we don't, we get those oops that we read about in the newspaper. You know, I'm very mindful of when we were doing the Oregon Health Plan last session, trying to restructure it, and the data kept moving and kept changing. And then following the session, there was some some forecasts that had been made that, that from a political standpoint really did us more damage than it did us good. So, you know, I concur with the good director that we do need the ability to be able to give this body good data. And so on average, I'm not with you, because having to make some decisions based on the kind of information that, has been received, we weren't able to hit, quote, our marks, and we weren't able to hit them within any 5 or 10%. So I need to put that on record, but I do encourage this body to look at the giving them the tools that they need with which to be able to provide us with the information that we request.
Thank you. Representative Henson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple quick comments. One, this reminds me a little bit of a story about three forecasters that went hunting, and a deer popped up in front of them, and the first one shot at it and missed 2 feet to the right. The second one shot and missed 2 feet to the left, and the third one said, "We got him." There's a certain element. When we're looking at the schedule, when we're submitting agency requests in September of 04 with a confidence that we're going to know what the numbers are in 07 in this arena, I think there's an incredible difficulty. And maybe one of the things that we should be looking at, besides the fact of trying to get the best forecasting we can, maybe changing some of the ways that we budget and going to maybe some annual budgeting that but certainly in an area that is this volatile that I don't know whether we're ever going to be able to really accurately forecast. So maybe our best hope is to realize what the limits of our forecasting are going to be, get as good as we can, and then realize that this is built in something that just can't be forecast with any more certainty than picking what the weather will be like 2 years from now.
Okay.
Chair Richardson, Representative Hansen, just a follow-up comment. We do take this very seriously, and the reality of doing these forecasts is accepting that from an industry standard, if you're within 1 or 2%, you're doing pretty well. When we're within 1 or 2% here, you're talking tens of millions of dollars, and so it is a very serious issue, and it's a very difficult task to try to accomplish. But we continue to work at it.
Excuse me, Chair. One additional.
Representative Henson.
In terms of getting within a 1 or 2% range of accuracy, how far out do you think you could forecast with confidence in that range?
Chair Richardson, Representative Henson. It's a fairly loaded question. Your comments about the closer you are to what you're forecasting time-wise, the more your chances are for being, I don't want to say accurate, but the farther you go out, the probabilities go down because there are so many intervening factors, some of which are totally unknown. One of the things that we are doing in this process is we will produce a forecast document, and that document will include those areas that we are unable to forecast, but they are risks to the forecast, and there are many of them. We are, as Gary said, we are not in a position where we have many other organizations also forecasting our programs. It's not like an economic forecast where they're are many, many organizations involved in that. And so it's a major challenge.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, I think the evidence being that most states have annual sessions, that evidence would probably say most states feel you probably can't do a good job predicting beyond a year. That's probably why they have annual sessions. It's easier to manage the budget. There's greater predictability and so on. We are, of course, in the minority in the sense that we don't do that, and that's not making a statement for annual sessions, but I think that sort of speaks to what would you say the reasonable period of time is. States as a general body meet every year, and they probably do that for a reason. Part of it is the predictability of not only the expenses but the revenues. So
I might mention that in going and talking with a fiscal analyst in Idaho, which has annual three-month sessions roughly, they were saying how they kind of were envious of Oregon because we have a biennial session and budgeting period, because what they find is doing it annually, that as soon as they sign EDI, the departments are working on the next year's budget. And so it's a budget process that, you know, whether it's 1 year or 2 years, you still have to go through the same hoops. And they felt like they liked the idea of only having to do it every 2 years. And so it may be a grass is greener kind of thing, although it certainly would be better if we had the more immediate information and data. Of course, as we look at a lot of the graphs that we get, it's not 2004 anyway. And so it's hard to know. Hard to know. Senator Winter.
Mr. Chair, and the uniqueness of looking at the department is because you're actually coming before us more than once a year or once every 2 years. Because of rebalance, they're constantly having to do budgeting here. And you're before us more than any other agency in state government. It's got its upside and it has its downside. Its upside is to allow you the flexibility in order to move money around and where you have caseload changes. The downside is that you're constantly budgeting for actually all through the biennium.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Winter, it's a pretty unique system, really. I haven't run into it in any other state that I've worked in where the largest agency, comes with some regularity to rebalance its whole budget. That just doesn't happen in other states, even those that have biennial sessions. They don't do a rebalance system like we do. And there is some advantage. You're saying to the department, this is how much money you have based on the forecasts that were the best and available to us. You have to manage to that and come back and show us how you're going to stay within the budget. And we have. I mean, during my two tenures, we haven't drawn from the emergency fund in the 7 years, other than for dedicated purposes, where the e-fund had a dedicated purpose, because we've managed to it. So,
mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, just to follow up, because the other positive to that is that coming before the legislative body, that I believe that it provides them with ongoing information and helps to shorten that learning curve, if you will, because you are before us to educate us on programs and what's occurring inside the agency. So I think that's another plus. If you have to wait 2 years before you're back before us, you miss information or you get misinformation or none at all.
Mm-hmm. Okay, maybe we need to move ahead so that we have time to do our performance measures.
Mr. Chair, that essentially concludes my testimony. The last two slides are just a distinction between caseload and workload, and then a relative measure of where we think we are in terms of progress. So if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay. Are there questions or comments? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We could talk a little bit about the performance measures, which should be behind the tab. And let me say, as a preference to this conversation, when the whole notion of performance measures first came about through the Progress Board, there was a decision made at that time that there weren't going to be performance measures on the administrative side. And so you don't see that in anything the Progress Board puts out, administrative performance measures for administration. And I think that's been a shortcoming in the whole performance measure system. When the governor, following the governor's election, when I came back to DAS, Cindy Becker and I began to work, and this was principally Cindy's assignment, on developing through DAS a set of performance measures for all administrative services in state government. So we'd have something to come before you with a set that we were all going to use. And that project is still underway. It wasn't done in time to help us for this budget, but it should be complete for the next budget, so you'll see for every agency a set of performance measures that apply to the administration. Having said that, what you've got here now is our best effort to put some performance measures on all the parts of the administration. And, you know, frankly, some of these are somewhat satisfying to me. Some of them are not what I would consider as good a measures as we could have. But we're in this interim period where we're trying to get a statewide set of performance measures. So what we've tried to do is give you a flavor of how we think we can measure our performance by the different services that are administrative. So when we talk about recoveries of resources, it's how do we compare with prior points of time, whether it was a year ago or a prior biennium. How long has it taken us to do recoveries? How much are we recovering by individual agent, revenue agent, and so on, so we can measure individuals' performance on the job as well as our total recoveries in a variety of different places. When you get into things like payroll and general accounting, it's really how many employees are you producing payrolls for? Are they on time? Are you having any problems with errors? Is the Secretary of State finding any exceptions to your processes in payrolls and general accounting and reconciliations? Those are just day-to-day activities. And mainly what you want to measure is, are you doing it right? And are you doing it in a timely way and in a way that creates the best revenue position for the state? In areas like information security, Bill touched on this, we want to track how many times are people trying to get into our system that don't belong there. You know, to what extent do people have an ability to break into our system, and how do we correct for that? Those are the kinds of things we're looking for on the security side of our information system. In human resources, we talked a little bit a week or so ago about the work that we've done to recruit a diverse workforce and the steps that we take to try to assure that we have recruitment, promotion, and retention of people of color and people with disabilities in our workforce. We also measure the number and type of workers' comp claims that we have, because we've got a very aggressive group that works throughout the agency to try to minimize workplace accidents. So we're looking at not just how many claims we have, but what are they? You know, what's the nature of these claims? What are the things that we could do to prevent these claims in the future? On facilities, our performance around facilities, it's about, you know, how do we locate our facilities? How long does it take us to get a facility ready? Telephone service orders, time to develop leases, assuring that our staff have adequate facilities to work in. How many people can we get into a building? And if you've ever been to our building three blocks from here, we've got about 1,200 people in a building, and it's pretty much wide open. There are very few private offices. It was designed that way so that we could accommodate as many people as possible. And so each floor is a sea of cubicles. The only permanent job in the DHS building, I think, are the group of guys that go around and move cubicles around and stuff. That's they have permanency. I think the rest of us are probably subject to leaving at any time. But that's an effort to just try to maximize our floor space as much as possible. In documents management, you know, we're talking about how long does it take to process OHP applications. What's the error rate? Number of days it takes us to get through MMIS, which is probably not a good measurement now because we're rewriting the whole MMIS system, and it'll have a very different system in a couple of years. So contracts, again, it's a timing issue, days to process a contract, number of problems or exceptions that we have in contracts are important to us. Information services, biggest one is the network down very much? You know, how long is the network up regularly? Because when the network's down, we can't do any work. And Bill would have the numbers, but our network rarely goes down except in the middle of the night for servicing. For OIS, when we look at application development, we want to know what did the project call for the development time, and then what did we actually do in terms of of completing projects. And the number of records that we lost or accessed without authorization, that's more of a security issue, I think, Bill, than it is anything else. So GAO, which is the Governor's Advocacy Office, we're interested in how long does it take to respond to a request from you as legislators or citizens who come into the advocacy office? How many days does it take to get a reasonable response? How do people feel about the response that they've been given? It's a customer service orientation for the GAO. You know, how do they perform in from a customer service perspective? So these are just the, I think, really pretty elementary ways of measuring performance. And, you know, my hope is that DAS will finish the performance measurements for all the state government, and we'll all be using the same measurements across every agency as to how our administrative services are being judged by the governor and by you as a legislative body.
Foster, comments, questions? Question. Representative Hannah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Weeks, just a couple of comments as we went through that list. If you back up to the first one, Office of Financial Service or the Institutional Revenue, I would think tracking whatever that AR balance is would be fairly important. If there's past due balances or an aging of those balances might be a critically important part of the revenue piece. If we're comparing current recoveries to past, can you age that recovery? Can you age that balance?
I think we already do age it.
Clyde,
why don't you come up for just a second? I'm going to ask Clyde Syke if he's responsible, but
Chair Richardson and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Clyde Syke. I'm the Chief Administrative Officer for the department. And Chair Richardson, Representative Hanna, that is something that we track quite a bit. And we also there's kind of a matrix of as these things age, the collections or the amount due, there are certain steps we have to take at a certain point in time. We have to turn it over to the Department of Revenue to look for them to make collections. And then after a certain amount of time, we also have to turn it over to, I believe, a private collection agency to have them follow up on the account. And so we do track how long it's taking us to collect. And then also related to that tracking, as I said earlier, there are different steps we have to take through that aging process to get that collected.
Can I follow up?
Do you know, we could probably find out what that balance is and how long you hold it on your aging until you turn it over to Department of Revenue or to the private?
Chair Richardson, Representative Hanna, I don't know offhand, but I can certainly get that for you fairly quickly.
Representative, do you want it aged by? I mean, do you want us to show you how old they are by month, or not even?
I'd like to see the method you use for tracking the aging.
Okay.
I've had some of those questions throughout this, and some of the agencies have had trouble providing an aging of their accounts receivable. So I'd just like to see how you handle that.
Okay.
And maybe a statement or two or a paragraph about the aging process, as you mentioned, in terms of how long you carry it before you turn it over.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Winters.
Since the DAS and they are required by statute to give us the information on the aging of account by not only Human Services but by other agencies, and there is a publication that is produced that addresses these particular issues, and if the information that you're seeking is not in there, then I think that's maybe one that we may ask for all agencies as well. But there is a report that is given to legislators on the aging of account and the turnover of those accounts to revenue and what success revenue is having at collecting them and then when they're to turn them over to private collectors.
Follow-up.
Representative. Senator Winters, I'm in possession of that book, and I've reviewed it. And just respectfully, I would like the agency to answer with some additional detail beyond what's in the book.
Yeah. I would like to, if there's more detail that's needed of them, I would suspect that there's probably of others, and maybe we should have a request in that all agencies bring forth those kind of details, and we can do that.
Yeah. I have further questions. To the medical payment recovery, in terms of, to some degree, you operate as an insurance carrier, and the days required for recovery from the agencies that you're billing, you track that in terms of you're requesting dollars from insurance companies, but are you tracking it days in terms of days?
Representative Chair Richardson and Representative Hanna, I'm not sure, but we could follow up, and I could have the manager of the unit prepare information on how we track and what time frames we use for tracking in the medical payment recovery unit and get that to you also.
Follow up? I would just imagine with the number of insurance providers that you track, because it would seem like in that payment recovery you would to some degree rank those providers based on potentially how well they took care of their payments.
Chair Richardson, Representative Hanna, I believe that's true, that we do prioritize.
Yeah. So we'd like to know a little more about that.
Yes.
Okay. And one last one within that list.
Yes, sir.
The human resources portion, and I realize these aren't, quote, performance measures within there, but we frequently hear about pay scale and benefits and all the number of things. So it would be nice to know what your turnover rate is within the agency that would help us determine how much problem you're having in terms of keeping employees, and then the average tenure of the folks within the department, again, to give us somewhat of a feeling for how well people like their jobs or how much they stick around.
Chair Richardson, Representative Hanna, I know we track that type of information, so that should be fairly easy to get for you.
Great.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanna, we generally expect about a 10% turnover every year. I mean, we churn about 10%. It's higher in some categories, and we should give you that too, so you can see where we have the most struggle in terms of recruiting and retaining people. I mean, like nurses and physicians and so on at the hospital are really difficult for us. There's turnover amongst our caseworkers as well, and in both on the senior side and the children's side. So, but we'll try to point out those some of those areas that are more critical.
Mm-hmm. Representative Hanna, just again as a follow-up, and I don't mean to be too particular to this, within that turnover rate then, do you track how many of the folks that you do lose, you lose in the industry, i.e. they leave for another department within the state or similar function? In other words, if your turnover rate's 10%, are half of those people leaving to go to another agency, or would that be... would you count them in your turnover rate if they left to leave for a different agency?
Yes,
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hanna, we do. When they leave for any purpose, we count them as their turnover. We can run against the current state employee list, so we'd know how many of our former employees are actually in some other agency.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we know who retired and are through the PERS system. So.
Mm-hmm. Great. Just.
Okay, we'll do the best we can to get that back to you.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, for all other parts of the agency, we've also given you a prioritized list of services. You don't have that for admin services because the list depends on what decisions and choices you all make. I mean, admin services is there to support programs. So when you look at our priority list, if whatever decisions you make affect admin services. So there's no way to give you a priority list of admin services. It's responsive to your choices. The reduction options have somewhat, there's a similar relationship there. Obviously, if you as a policy body decide to limit or do away with some services that affects department-wide services, we did give you though a sheet of reductions that we thought we could reasonably make, and most of those are, you know, things that you'd expect: changes to our service supply budgets, doing away with some of our contracting support that we have, closing down some buildings, and making, you know, clients go to more a more centralized facility, which means a little bit more travel and so on, but we have that option. We can close buildings and centralize our services in some places. There are some eliminations of positions on the list here. We can adjust the timing on computer projects. We can slow down development on things to save money, and we put both MMIS and the SACWIS, which is the Child Welfare Information System, on that list. I would advise against that and hope that you wouldn't ask us to do that, but you can manage your costs by slowing down your projects and delivering the results at a later point in time. And that could be, these are examples that get us to the 10% cut, but you could pick other places where the legislature could say, well, we want you to slow down development of this or that, and that will, in effect, reduce the cost and stretch out the development at some point. So,
question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Winters.
The staffing study that is in process did not include the administrative support staff, did.
The staffing study is only on food stamps and Medicaid. That was were the three areas that we were directed to look at. But there is, I'm sorry, Senator Winters and Mr. Chairman, there are implications on the on the support staff from that staffing study, you know, because the fallout, once you determine the staffing levels in some of those areas, there's a fallout connection to the support staff as well.
Any other questions? Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The 10% cut list that we have been provided with is $25.6 million, correct? And that is of the...
Total funds. Yes.
Total funds. Okay. That is of the department-wide support services, and I thought that budget for total funds was like $410 million. I'm missing total. Something?
Okay. Total funds, yeah.
Okay, so the discrepancy of 10%.
The 10%, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanna, is a department-wide 10%.
Okay, all right.
So that if you looked across at the whole department, you should see a 10%. We've done this several times ourselves to make sure. But
okay, well, that answers the question.
I don't follow that.
Well, this is just one part of DHS. The 10% is for all of the department, and so there may be another department which has more than 10, and this is okay. Less. So as long as they have 10% for the whole DHS,
for the total.
Then it's okay.
Okay. We were not asked to do it.
No, that.
Okay. Thank you.
Understandable. Any other questions? Would you mind taking a moment and explaining where we're at on the staffing study, what phase we're at, and when we will hear from them, and what information you might have?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, and am I better to do this, or are you?
I can do it if you'd like.
We have a contract signed with a private sector contractor to work on the study, and Clyde understands the timing on it better than I do, so I'll turn to him.
Chair Richardson, members of the committee, the contractor is on board and has been doing their field work, and as a matter of fact, they've completed their field work. The steering committee is meeting with the contractor today, and hopefully Ms. Baker will be able to attend, and we will be reviewing what they found as part of their field work. Once that's completed, we'll identify areas where they need to do either more work or more follow-up, and once that's completed, they'll begin working on the first draft of the report. And I believe the first draft of the report is due in late April, early May, if I remember correctly.
Okay. Thank you. All right.
Mr. Chairman, that concludes our formal presentation. We're happy to go back and answer other questions about any part of the department-wide support services that members may have. So.
Okay, are there any other questions at this point? Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are we going to discuss this budget to any greater degree, or are we done with this, or can we ask some of those questions now.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, the model for this session's budget hearings were to do the phase one program overview things, and that we have completed that. We'll get more into the actual budget numbers, and particularly once we see the department's rebalance and the reshoot of the governor's budget, we'll have a better idea of where the numbers line up for each of the program areas. But that's not to say that you can't ask questions now that the department could bring back later for phase two discussion. But generally, the idea of the phase one was the high-level overview, understanding the program so that we could get the subcommittee into the priority process.
And as far as the prioritization, we have some questions that Representative Hanna has put together that we'd like to give you now so that you could respond tomorrow. And then tomorrow, we would like to actually discuss, just get questions that we may have on to help us prioritize, to help us make sure that we understand why something was done, or just any kind of questions we may have on the priority list that we have from DHS, so that we can do our job to present for the co-chairs a recommended prioritization for the Human Services Department. Okay. And then I'm also putting together a PICS data request, which I'll have for you by tomorrow as well. But you won't need to be responding on that.
Okay, so Mr. Chairman, you're going to give us some questions at some point then? Okay, thank you.
Right here. Mm-hmm. All right, so with that, we'll adjourn for the day. Thank you.
Thank you.